Hello, it's Tuesday 22nd of September. I'm Hannah Pearson from Pear Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
On this week's show, we're taking a virtual trip to Japan, the land of the rising sun.
Yes, forget those overhyped flights to nowhere. Our destination is Tokyo, one of my favourite cities. So welcome aboard. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So we're leaving Southeast Asia behind this week for one of our occasional podcasts where we analyse a popular destination for Southeast Asian travellers.
Yes, Japan was primed for its biggest ever tourism year in 2020, with the Tokyo Olympics set to top the bill. But sadly, it wasn't to be. Hopefully next year. So Hannah, we've mentioned on the pod before, but Japan was really ramping up its destination marketing to the travel trade and to consumers in the past couple of years here in Southeast Asia.
Yes, I mean, we've certainly seen a growing interest from Southeast Asians to travel to Japan, and we'll talk about stats in just a minute. But even in terms of the tourism board activities here in Southeast Asia, that's really grown immensely too. I remember we were talking in one of the first podcasts we did back in January about the Thailand International Travel Fair that I went to, TITF. And that was dominated by Japanese tourism organizations, not just on the national level, but also on the regional level, on a city level as well.
So if we set the scene, where we're at the end of 2019, we'd seen this huge growth throughout the 2010s in tourism into Japan.
We had.
And as we saw at the end of that decade, there was a move to encourage more Southeast Asians to travel. And there's a good reason for that, because the inbound market to Japan was dominated by primarily four markets.
Yes.
China, Hong Kong, South Korea, and Taiwan. I think collectively that accounted for about 70% of the total arrivals.
Something.
So there was a need to diversify. There was a huge interest in Southeast Asian travelers to go to Japan, particularly for the Sakura season.
Yes. And not to mention things like the food, especially in Southeast Asia. It's hard to go around even the cities here without bumping into a Japanese restaurant on pretty much every corner. So food is definitely a big drive towards visiting Japan. And it's been interesting to see a real growth in the way that the Japan Tourism Board has also been targeting Muslim travellers as well from the region. So there's certainly been a move for it to become a lot more of a Muslim-friendly destination. Lots of halal-certified restaurants popping up, even in Tokyo Disneyland, I think, now. So there's been this real push from inside the trade as well to recognise that Southeast Asia is a growing market for them, and that if they want to tap onto markets such as Indonesia and Malaysia, then they have to have these kind of Muslim-friendly facilities available for travellers.
Yeah, so there's a couple of key points there we'll pick out from what you said there, Hannah. One, obviously, was this growth of Chinese tourism from about 2010 onwards. Huge volumes of Chinese tourists throughout the year. And one of the key factors of that was another point that you mentioned, that's food tourism.
Yeah.
Now, Tokyo became the first Asian city to get a Michelin restaurant guide in 2007. And this really ramped it up as a gourmet destination. Chinese travelers were particularly interested in going over to Japan because it's very close and to try out all these different restaurants. Now, by 2016, for 9 years, Tokyo had consecutively recorded the highest number of Michelin-starred restaurants of any city in the world, more than Paris. So then Michelin started to open up across the country, so there are more restaurants listed in other destinations.
Interesting.
And Japan really, really played on this, particularly in China.
Ah, I hadn't realised that. That's very interesting.
But the other key factor for the growth of Chinese travellers was this, what was called explosive buying.
Explosive buying? Tell me more.
Bakugai, it's called.
Bakugai.
Yeah, so this is from about 2012 onwards. There was a huge surge of flight openings from China into Japan, into different cities, not just into Tokyo or to Osaka, but also to places like Fukuoka. And what happened was that the retail outlets and the retail stores, particularly cosmetics brands, alcohol brands, luxury goods brands, they really started offering incredible discounts for Chinese travelers. And Chinese travelers bought up these products in huge, huge amounts. Explosive shopping. This became a sort of meme in Japan at the time. I mean, I was in Japan back in 2011 in Tokyo, and I remember walking through one of the big department stores in Tokyo. And they were everywhere. There were promotions only for Chinese travellers.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that's back in 2011.
Oh, explosive spending.
Yeah, explosive spending.
And we can really see an increase in tourism from 2013. So there were a lot more tourism-oriented policies from the PM Abe as well. And one of the key things he did, which particularly generated growth from Southeast Asia, was exempted visas for many countries. Yep. So we saw Thailand and Malaysia no longer needing to have a visa. Philippines and Vietnam were allowed multiple entry visas. Indonesia's visa was extended to a validity of 15 days. So all of that combined just made it so much easier to visit Japan. And, you know, it was an exciting new destination. So the growth really exploded.
Yeah, that was a strategic decision to relax visas. I think it was for 40 countries initially.
Mm.
And at the same time, the yen was depreciating.
Mm.
So Japan was always seen as an expensive destination, yeah. But with the yen depreciating, visa access a lot easier.
Yeah.
Now that's it gave the Japan National Tourism Organization a lot more tools to work with in terms of promoting it as a destination. And if you look at some of the figures, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So as you mentioned there, 2013, Hannah, that's the first time that Japan surpassed 10 million annual visitors in 1 year. And 2015 was the first time since the Osaka World Expo in 1970 where inbound tourists exceeded the number of Japanese traveling abroad. So that's only in 2015, five years ago.
2015. No, that's really interesting. I mean, and since then, actually, the outbound numbers, they've not really grown very much, have they? So 2019, it was about 20 million. So it's not a huge increase. But what, obviously, you say has been increasing is this inbound number. So 2010, there were just 8.6 million visitors to Japan. By 2019, last year, there were 31.9 million. So that's an increase of 270%.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
It is. And actually, I think this took Japan by surprise because I wrote a report on Japan back in 2015.
Yeah.
And back in 2015, they'd already secured the rights to host the Olympics in 2020. Mm. And for 2020, they were hoping for a target of 20 million visitors in 2020. Wow. So they easily surpassed that.
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning of the year, their forecast was for 34.3 million.
Yeah, so and by 2030, 60 million.
Oh my gosh.
Astonishing figures.
It is. I mean, and it's really interesting when you look at numbers from Southeast Asia to Japan in particular. So I won't go into every single country, but in terms of percentage growth, there are some insane numbers coming out from there. So between 2010 to 2019, growth from Vietnamese travelers to Japan increased by 1,083%. That's crazy, right? Philippines by 692%. Thailand 514%. It makes Malaysia's 338% look quite modest.
Yeah, it really does.
This is really a huge achievement.
Yeah.
So nowadays, travelers from Southeast Asia to Japan account for about 12% of total arrivals, which is not shabby, is it?
No, it's very impressive. I mean, as we said earlier, those four main markets of China, South Korea, Hong Kong, and Taiwan have really dominated the market over recent years. But you can see how Japan was really trying to pivot and attract more travelers from eager markets like Southeast Asia. I mean, a key factor there, obviously, is that Asia provided 84.5% of visitors to Japan last year.
Mm.
And that was up from 75% in 2012. So there's obviously a big shift away, well, quite a significant shift away from long-haul markets.
Yep. I mean, and of course, Japanese travelers into Southeast Asia are really, really important too. So generally, you know, for Cambodia, they're the sixth largest market, Indonesia the sixth, Singapore the sixth, Thailand the sixth. And you've got places like Vietnam and Myanmar where they're third, Philippines fourth. So Japan really plays a key role, not only for outbound travel from Southeast Asia, but also it's inbound to Southeast Asia too.
Yeah. And another factor, which obviously this year has become much more important, is the domestic market.
Mm.
It's often underestimated just how strong the Japanese domestic market is. Last year, spending in the Japanese domestic market was about 22 trillion Japanese yen.
Mm.
And that compares to inbound spending of 4.8 trillion. So clearly it outpaces inbound spending by a significant factor.
Which is probably a good thing for them right now. So they're standing in a much better stead.
Yeah. And if we look at why Southeast Asian travelers attracted to Japan.
Yeah.
Now, there are a number of the factors which we mentioned there. The gourmet factor is definitely one of those. Yes. It's a country of mystery. It's a country of anime. It's a country of theme parks.
Yeah.
It's a country of efficiency.
Yes.
But it also has other factors that make it quite attractive seasonally. So we mentioned the Sakura.
Yes.
The cherry blossom season, which is a huge, huge event. This year was supposed to be the biggest ever Sakura visitation in Japan's history. Mm. Obviously, that didn't happen. It's a big winter sports destination.
True.
Particularly up in Hokkaido. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people from KL that go skiing there each year.
Mm. Yeah, and it's one that, you know, especially, I guess, from being from the UK, you don't tend to think of Japan as a winter sports destination. But yeah, it absolutely is.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, it burnished its appeal a few years ago when it hosted the Winter Olympic mm-hmm. Games. Yeah. You mentioned their Muslim tourism made some efforts there.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And, you know, throughout the games, and it's not just Tokyo the focus of this, but it's throughout the country. You can go to Hokkaido and find Muslim restaurants. You can go to Okinawa and find Muslim restaurants. And that has really boosted the number of inbound tourists from countries like Malaysia and Indonesia.
Yeah. And another aspect, I guess, is sports tourism.
Mm.
Obviously, this year was the Olympic year. It was supposed to be 2020. You know, the whole country has been gearing up for this since 2013 when it actually won the rights for that.
Mm.
But last year, exactly a year ago, it hosted the Rugby World Cup,
mm.
which was hosted around the country.
Yep.
It was a hugely successful event.
Yes.
It was hosted from September through to the beginning of November.
Yep.
And September, the first month of the tournament, it got a 5% uplift in visitors compared to the year before. So it generated a lot of interest and also generated a sense of belief that it would be able to host a very successful Olympics just a few months later.
Yeah, absolutely. And I found some nice stat that Irish tourists, who would never normally have visited Japan, suddenly had this increase as well. And the increases were always around the same time to be timed for the Ireland rugby matches. So I think it opened up the country to different markets as well, who perhaps would not have considered Japan before.
Yeah. So there was this huge expectation that this year was going to be a massive tourism year, basically surrounding the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
It got off to a slower start at the beginning of the year. Usually the early couple of months would have been a bit stronger than they were this year.
Mm.
That's probably because a lot of people were tailoring their visits for Sakura season and then for the Olympics.
True.
But obviously neither of those have actually happened.
No.
The Olympics were actually cancelled towards the end of March.
Yes. I think
they were supposed to take place in July and August. So from that point to the rest of the year, obviously it's been a huge puncturing of the bubble for Japan.
Absolutely. I mean, so the 2021 Olympics are now scheduled between 23rd of July to 8th of August next year. I guess there is still really a question mark, isn't there, if we're honest, whether that's going to happen. I mean, it looks to all intents and purposes like Japan is still gearing up for that. But it must be hard to try and gear up for that, but at the same time have backup plans in place just in case they're not ready.
Yeah, absolutely. The International Olympic Committee had a meeting at the beginning of September in Japan. Well, it was a virtual meeting, obviously.
Yeah.
And the sentiments coming out of that were very mixed.
Mm.
And it did sound very much as though it's going to rely on vaccine development.
Yeah.
But also, even if there is a vaccine, you know, you're bringing together not just visitors from around the world, but you're bringing together elite athletes from around the world. To put them into one place, it's going to be an incredible logistical challenge.
Yes.
Japan itself has been a little bit non-committal on whether it will or won't host the games. It obviously really wants to, but I think it's very aware that within 12 months it could be logistically impossible.
Yeah.
And I've noticed also from its website, it hasn't yet changed its logo. It still says Olympics 2020. And the website includes no information about what's really going to happen going forward.
Interesting. So they're keeping it vague, which is probably better,
sensible
for the long run. Yeah. So what's the current situation for COVID at the moment in Japan?
Okay, so the current figures as they stand today, 79,140 confirmed cases, 1,500 deaths, 71,404 people have actually recovered.
Okay, so that's pretty hopeful then.
Japan was one of the first countries to get a confirmed case outside of China.
Yeah.
Close proximity to China.
Yes.
And at that time, there were a lot of people traveling from China to Japan back and forth. There's so much business travel between the two countries.
Yes. And Chinese New Year as well.
And Chinese New Year was coming,
A lot of it really kicked off. I think that the cases really kicked off with the plague ship, right? The Diamond Princess.
Yep, the Diamond Princess cruise ship, which was quarantined in Yokohama Harbor for almost 2 months.
That's crazy.
Can you believe this? It actually started on February the 3rd. That seems like a long time ago.
Yeah, when I was looking at this, I thought, oh my God, I didn't realize it was for that long. Yeah. Imagine being on the ship for that long.
Yeah. So it arrived in port on February the 3rd and actually left on the 26th of March. It had 3,711 crew and passengers on board. Obviously, a lot of people couldn't get off the ship. 712 people actually tested positive.
Gosh.
And 13 people actually died. And they weren't actually just Japanese. They were travelers from around the world.
Yeah, so I think that one was such a high-profile case at the time, wasn't there? There was a lot of controversy over whether the quarantine procedures were strict enough, whether it was handled, you know, in the right kind of manner. You know, they called it completely chaotic quarantine. That was one quote about it. And I think that this drew a lot of attention to Japan, whether they liked it or not, right, at the start of COVID.
I think it also caused a lot of controversy within the country. There was a lot of anger that this had actually been allowed to happen.
Yes.
And as you say, that the controls on board the ship and the segregation of passengers who tested positive and those who hadn't didn't seem to have been red zone, green zone.
Mm-hmm.
That came out a little bit later. But yeah, it really was a huge event at the time.
So, I mean, that kind of kicked off a lot of the subsequent cases in Japan. So what about now then? Is domestic travel allowed?
Well, you see, that's also been a bit of controversy, hasn't it? So the government of Shinzo Abe, the former prime minister,
who
resigned recently, invested money into the Go To Travel campaign, which started, I think, on the 22nd of July.
Yep.
This was aimed to reinvigorate domestic travel. Now, we know that domestic travel in Japan, particularly for business travel, is very, very strong. But there's also people travel around the country. But that had really tapered off. There was a fear of the virus.
Mm.
People weren't traveling.
Yep.
The big metropolis, Tokyo, had the highest number of cases.
Yes.
And people were very reticent of either leaving or visiting. And that sort of circulated around the country that there was this fear of actually moving around.
Yes.
So this go-to travel campaign was initiated. It didn't include Tokyo.
Mm.
But at the time, a lot of Japanese were saying that we shouldn't be doing this. Although we want to travel, it's the wrong time.
Yeah.
And all we're going to do is just spread the virus around the country.
Yeah, there was a really high disapproval rate, wasn't there? I mean, it's a big budget. It's $16 billion.
Yeah.
So, I mean, actually, you compare that to some of the other budgets that are around in Southeast Asia for domestic stimulus, it's nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing compared to $16 billion.
And it was basically subsidized, wasn't it? So it's about 35% of travelers' costs. Depended whether you traveled for a longer trip or you took a day trip, there were variegated rates. Mm. But it was quite substantial in terms of trying to invigorate people to travel again.
Yeah, so I mean, between 27th of July to 3rd of September, about 7.81 million travelers. So, you know, it definitely stimulated some demand there. And I think from October, they're actually increasing the stimulus. So they're giving an additional 15% for coupons for things like food or activities to try and stimulate that side of it as well, rather than just accommodation. It will be interesting because they're also set to include Tokyo, aren't they, within the campaign soon.
From October the 1st, I believe.
I think so, yeah. So that will be interesting to see what impact that has.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of case numbers, in terms of people's general sentiment about traveling as well.
And this weekend was a four-day holiday, the silver holiday.
Yes.
So I guess we'll also get some statistics, just as you mentioned there, about, well, the number of people that traveled, but also the lag in terms of whether there was any case transmission from those travels.
I mean, certainly there's high expectations for it. So before it happened, they were saying that planes were almost full. They were expecting the highest levels of travel since February. So I think hopes are really being pinned high to this.
Yeah.
But it is coming off a week that has had quite a few highs in terms of case numbers. I mean, yesterday was the lowest number of... So yesterday was Monday. It was the lowest case numbers that it had in a week. So it was 312. But I guess the fear is still whether these case numbers are going to go up or down, like you said, and the impact from traveling around the country on that.
Yeah. And you set there the figure of the subsidy, that it's such a huge figure.
Mm.
But if you set that against the economic situation in Japan at the moment, there is a real need to reboot the economy. You know, it's really struggling.
Yeah.
If you go back to sort of the 2010s when Abenomics first started, that was basically to restart an economy that had been stagnant for so long.
Yeah.
And tourism was a key part of that.
Yeah.
And throughout the 2010s, you could see that growth was starting to bring in the revenues.
Yeah.
The problem, obviously, in the last three quarters, Japan now has had three quarters of contractions.
Mm.
It's officially in recession.
Mm-hmm.
But the last quarter is astonishing. I mean, it's 28.1% contraction compared to the same quarter the year before.
Yeah. Yeah. They say it's the biggest drop since 1955.
Yeah. Now, there is some good news.
Mm. Got them.
Analysts are saying that that really was a period where no economic activity, no social activity was happening.
Yeah.
And wouldn't say normal, but activity is recovering, particularly in Tokyo.
Yes.
And there is hopes that around about a 4-5% rebound on that 28.1% contraction should happen in the next quarter, which would at least give a little bit of confidence to the economy and to investors that maybe 2021 will be a stronger year.
Yeah. And of course, now to add to this kind of mix, we've got our new PM there as well, don't we? So Abe resigned due to ill health, and now we have Suga. So Suga, in terms of policies, it seems like Suga is going to pursue a fairly similar pathway to Abe, he said, we need to push forward with the efforts the Abe government had been making. That is my mission, he said.
And also, the interesting thing about him, Yoshihide Suga is his name, and he was previously the cabinet secretary before he came prime minister.
Yeah.
And he has a link to tourism. Now, he actually said a couple of months ago, when the launch of the Go To Travel campaign, he was a proponent of actually trying to stimulate growth in tourism. So he said that the rationale for such a big subsidy, as you mentioned there, Hannah, was there are 9 million people working in the tourism industry in Japan, and we can say at the moment that the industry is dying.
Yeah.
And that's why he actually opened the coffers to actually try and boost the tourism industry.
Oh, that's so good news that he's an advocate for tourism then. So what else has been happening in Japan at the moment? Well, I mean, a few weeks ago, we were talking about how Japan had gone on this tour of Southeast Asia as well. And there's definitely an element of, I would say, maybe competition with China in terms of diplomacy here in the region. Would you say that?
Absolutely. Diplomacy and strategic investment and, yeah, for the future, for sure.
Yeah. So they have negotiated a few kind of very limited agreements with countries like Myanmar, Cambodia, and Laos, where they're going to allow residents to enter back in Japan. The interesting agreement that they have got set up is with Singapore, which will allow business travel, which is, you know, I'm sure a really positive move forward for both countries. I think they've both got very strong trade links with one another. So I think that opened up on the 18th of September. Again, it's all very strictly controlled. You've got to obey certain protocols. You've got to follow a very tightly controlled 14-day itinerary. But certainly a step forwards. And it will be interesting to see whether they really manage to negotiate a similar kind of thing with Thailand. I mean, Thailand in particular, we've seen, you know, they're key inbound outbound markets with each other, key business partners with one another. Or Malaysia as well. But nothing has come out yet about them. But I imagine that it's going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, Malaysia's an interesting case because Mahathir is obviously quite close to Japan. Mm. He's obviously no longer prime minister. So that's quite an interesting one to see what this current government, what their links are with the Japanese government.
Yes.
And another factor from Malaysia as well is that Tony Fernandez, AirAsia's CEO, he said quite recently when he was asked about the situation with the company and will it survive.
Yeah.
And one of the areas that he suggested may not survive
was
its Japan's operation.
Yes, it did. And he hinted on maybe we might focus our attention on ASEAN rather than Japan.
I think to paraphrase, his words were that if we had loads of money, we would continue that operation.
Yeah, but we don't.
But clearly they don't.
Yes, they were probably not.
But looking ahead, so obviously there is this, whether it's going to happen, it's in doubt, is the 2021 Olympics and the Paralympics as well. But Japan also seems to be investing for the future. There are a few big tourism infrastructure projects that are actually happening. Should we talk about a couple of those, Hannah?
Yeah, exactly. So one of the, I guess, more out there, literally out there kind of ones is their spaceport. So this is on Okinawa. They're building an airport that will target sending Chinese travelers to space. Space, and then it's about 100 kilometers up, so it's technically space, I think, according to the definitions. It would be quite a short flight. They'll get about 5 minutes of that kind of feeling of being an astronaut floating around in the sky. But they're targeting it to be open by 2025.
Yeah, by 2025, they hope to have 100 people that will be sort of the guinea pigs for this, right? But by 2030, they're hoping to take 1,000 people into space each year. The cost, did you see the cost?
Yeah, it's not cheap, is it?
15 million yen.
So about 141,000
US dollars per person, per flight.
So if you've got that kind of loose change floating around.
Yeah. And as you mentioned there, it's an island off of Okinawa. There's actually an airport there. This is a training airport. And they're building this special runway. For a spaceport, which is interesting.
Yeah, super interesting.
A slightly smaller scale, two theme parks, the Harry Potter theme park, and an expansion of Disneyland, which actually happens quite soon.
Yeah, so the Disneyland one opens, next week, 28th of September. So that's really soon, and it's the biggest expansion that they've had yet on Tokyo Disneyland. Of course, they've got Tokyo Disneyland and Tokyo Disney Sea as well. So this is the Disneyland park.
Yep. So which that's opened in 1983.
Interesting. Good stats. And yeah, the Harry Potter theme park. So it's not quite known yet whether this is going to be more like a studios tour like in London, which is obviously super popular, booked out all of the time, where you're kind of exploring the film sets from Harry Potter, or if it's going to be more like what they already have at Universal Studios Japan, which is kind of a Harry Potter themed rides. Maybe it'll be a combination of the two, but whatever it is, I'm sure it will be popular because both of those attractions, you know, both at Universal Studios Japan and Warner Brothers Studios in London, are really, really popular with tourists.
Yeah. And the other aspect that Japan had been looking to promote and looking to develop is casino tourism on a similar model to Macau, but also to Singapore. Yep. Singapore has two integrated resorts. Macau has several.
Yeah.
But Japan was really looking at Macau as the model. Similarly to Singapore, casino gambling was illegal in Japan. They changed the law back in 2018, I believe. They've been speaking to all the same operators of the Macau casinos.
Yeah.
So the big American companies, the big Hong Kong companies, to try and build initially three. I think two would be in and around Tokyo, Yokohama, and one would be in Osaka. Initially, the idea was that this would happen by about the Olympic time, but that's obviously not going to happen now. It's been pushed back for a number of reasons. Now the pandemic's pushing these further back. Some of the American, big American companies have actually pulled out because they're saying that the withholding tax on casino winnings is too high, and the gaming tax is also quite high as well. But the Hong Kong companies seem to be still interested. So this probably will happen, but not yet.
And one of the last kind of new attractions that they're building is the Tokyo Torch Tower. So this is set to be the tallest tower in Japan. It's going to be 390 meters tall, opening in 2027 with an observation deck taller than Tokyo Tower. So presumably the highlight is that you can see Tokyo Tower from the Tokyo
Tower. And a luxury hotel on the top.
Yeah. So it's part of an overall urban regeneration program that they're focusing on for Tokyo. So there's still plenty going on in Japan, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And also there's another super tower being built in Osaka, apparently, 330 meters high. So it's going to have these two new mega towers.
It's all about skyscrapers.
It's all about views. It's all about views.
Right. So that brings us to the end of our Japan special edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. We hope you enjoyed the show, and as always, we'd love to read your feedback on what we said, or maybe we missed out. So email us at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com, and look out for our daily travel insights and podcast news on LinkedIn at the Southeast Asia Travel Show, and Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yeah, meanwhile, you can catch up with our 36 previous episodes of the Southeast Asia Travel Show, and 5 editions of the Friday Rewind Show on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com. We're on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each one.
So that's a wrap for this week. We'll be back later this week with edition 6 of the Friday Rewind Show. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.